All right, welcome to Greek Club at Concordia Seminary. Today we are broadcasting from high atop Quantum Physics Tower, and our theological symposium is going on, and we've just heard a theoretical physicist give a lecture. So to escape into clarity and a lack of ambiguity, we're going to read Hebrews. Yeah, right. So anyway, we are reading the letter to the Hebrews, continuing, and we are in chapter 8 and verse 3. Now, to back up, the main point, as the writer has summed up in verse 1, is, to go quickly through 1 and 2, we have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. And this high priest is a laetur gus, there at the beginning of verse 2, a servant of the holy things and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord erected, not a man. Right, and so that's where we ended up last week. So we'll pick up with verse 3, and it could be read at least something like this. Paskar archiereus eis ta pros pherein dorata kai thysias kathistatai. Hathen anankaion ekein te kai tuton ha pros anenke. So the superiority of Christ is now going to be explained, and that's the gar with which verse 3 begins. Of course, gar is post-positive, so it's in second position. 4, every high priest, and now to find the main verb, we scan to the middle of the next line, kathistatai. This is from our friend kathistemi, and it's, let's see, what is this? I suppose it looks like a perfect form. Is appointed kathistomai, or is it just a present indicative? I think it's just a present indicative. If I'm wrong, forgive me. Every priest is appointed, and now we have a purpose construction. Eis ta plus the infinitive, right? Which is a classic a purpose construction in Greek. In order to, and what will the chief priest do? He'll prospero. It means to bring forward or to offer, especially in a cultic context, to offer sacrifices. And that's what he, in fact, offers that trails along after the infinitive. Dora te kai thysias. So dora, te is another little particle. You don't see it as much in the New Testament, but it's also post-positive. So put it in front of dora, gifts, and maybe translate both gifts and sacrifices, thysias. And I wonder, actually, given the nature of his argument, if there is some significance to the fact that it's a present infinitive, prosferein. So does this mean regularly offer? Because you remember early on the argument was Christ is the superior chief priest because he doesn't have to keep doing it over and over again, right? So it's possible at least that the verbal aspect of the present infinitive is of some significance, although often, I at least don't feel like I can be absolutely sure what the nuance is going on there. Hathen can mean whence, from this, or therefore, and probably means the latter here. And now we don't have a real verb, but we've got the adjective anankaion, necessary, or necessity, and you just supply is. Something is necessary. And what is necessary? An infinitive construction. That's what's necessary. So to have, supply is, anankaion. To have is necessary. And then you attach all the rest of that stuff in the verse to the infinitive to have. So to have te, something, also tuton is almost certainly the subject of the infinitive. So whence also, this one also, to have, which he may offer, the relative clause at the end. Let's see, what would that, something which he may offer. I suppose it goes with te. So that's what's necessary. So if you wanted to give a translation that would reflect the infinitive construction as the subject, which is technically what it is, you'd say this. Therefore, this one also to have something which he may offer is necessary. That's the way you'd translate it. And we just introduced the strong aorist in elementary Greek yesterday, and it was great to see the shock and awe look on their faces when we went through the first three principal parts of pharaoh. Pharaoh, oizo, einenkon, right? And so here we have, actually, we have pros pharaoh, and then we have pros enenke, so which would be, what would that be? The aorist subjunctive active, third singular. So it looks a little unusual to me to have an aorist subjunctive there at the very end. But I think with a relative clause, you can get away with that. What I would personally like to see would be something like ha on or ha e'on. But I think the better Greek writers won't necessarily need to put that on particle in there for the relative clause to be expressing some sort of futurity or uncertainty, something like that. So since every high priest has to have something to offer, this high priest also has to have an offering that he brings. And, of course, it won't be an offering in the earthly tabernacle. It will be an offering in the heavenly tabernacle. And we get an interesting men de that's coming up here starting at verse 4. So anyway, that's to make some sense grammatically out of verse 3. Comments, questions, anything that anybody sees?
There's nothing that tips you off to this subjunctive except for maybe that it is necessary. It kind of puts it in the realm of futurity, conjecture, like hopefully this happens.
Well, that's a good question, Will. I think it's more permissible than a New Testament guy like me would realize that the simple relative pronoun can function as a conditional relative clause and not just as a relative clause. So not just a which, but whichever he may offer. Yeah, I just think there's the flexibility there with relative clauses. It looks strange to me, but again, I've spent basically my entire life reading the New Testament that tends to make things simpler, as you know, and more explicit. So,
did you say something about the T being connected, something which also he might bring?
Yeah, I think the T has to be the object of the infinitive. This one, to have something. And then I suppose the relative pronoun technically would have as its antecedent the T, something which he may offer, I think. That makes sense? Yeah. Pars or die, right? So, yeah, word order. I've been noticing that Jim Bells kindly gives you Greek exercises and the word order is like it would be in English.
Yeah.
Subject first, verb second, that kind of thing. So, yeah. Why not? Yeah, early on. Yeah, well, early on he does. That's right, yeah.
When there's a subject of an infinitive and an object of an infinitive, is the pattern, do you know anything about the pattern that they put, or is it just totally
good
random?
Good question. Context is the general, you know, response to how do you tell. I think that's the only way, to know, because they'd both be accusative case, right? Here it's hard to have it make sense the other way. In fact, as I was reading, I kind of stopped too soon, and then I saw the Teuton, and I thought, oh, wait, this sort of has to be the subject, this one, right? So, yeah, but I can't think of an example right now, but there are some interesting ambiguities with infinitive constructions in the New Testament where you have an accusative subject and accusative object, and it could go either way. So, okay, good. Let's go on to verse 4. And we'll just take that then. Isn't Greek great? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 words, and the longest one has 3 letters. I mean, Hebrew is a good language, but Greek is a great language.
We have these triliteral roots.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, you do get to disappear root letters sometimes, so that's good. Yeah. Okay, verse 4. Amen un ein epiges ud an. Now, that's an important word. Ein hiereus. Unton, ton pros feronton katanamon ta dora. So we start with if, right? And we have men, and we have un. I think we have to put the un first in our translation. So therefore, so then. And then we have a men on the one hand, and we don't get the de until verse 6. Okay? I had to look for it quite a long time yesterday. So this is a big on the one hand. And again, this is the essential structure of this part of Hebrews' argument, right? So therefore, if on the one hand, now ein is just the indicative or the imperfect indicative of eime. So literally, he was upon earth. Ude, not even. See, and now as soon as you see on, a klaxon alarm has to go off in your head. And you have to go back, and now you've realized you have a contrary to fact conditional sentence. Because if you have a plus an indicative, and then in the apodosis, or the then clause, if you have on plus an indicative, past time indicative, contrary to fact. So you have to say something like this, for if he were on earth, not even would he be a priest. Okay? And now a genitive absolute, anton, ton, prosferanton. So, do it woodenly. The bringing according to the law, the gifts one, being. Now, what the heck does this mean? See? I think the sense is something. Remember that genitive absolutes are just predicate position participles, and so they can be causal, conditional, concessive, temporal, whatever. This one actually makes a fair amount of sense if you translate it causally. So, therefore, if he were on the earth, and it's referring to our great high priest, and presumably to the work he did, if he were on the earth, he would not even be a priest because there are those who bring, according to the law, gifts. In other words, on the earth you don't need any. You got priests, right? And they're busy all the time. Again, it's in my mind at least a fairly strong argument that the Jerusalem cultus is still going on. Right? It's not a killer argument, but I think it is an argument for a date prior to AD 70 for the letter to the Hebrews. The other shoe is going to drop when the writer makes clear again that Christ does his sacrificial work in the true heavenly tabernacle, not in the one on the earth, right? But on the one in heaven, if I can say it that way. So he's setting that up with verse 4. So again, you have a contrary to fact conditional sentence and then a genitive absolute, which I think makes some sense if it has a causal sense, because there are those who offer, according to the law, gifts. So Christ's priesthood, it takes place in a different place, right? And it's, of course, a different sacrifice. Questions about that? That was a little awkward when I tried to work with that. So the on is the dead giveaway that you have a contrary effect, conditional sentence. Okay? All right, we'll just keep going then, and verse 5 is fairly long. But it introduces what, for the writer, is a key statement from Exodus 25. And now let's talk about these ones who bring, according to the law, gifts on earth. Hoitines. Who? So hoitines hippodegmata kai skia la triuzin ton ep uraneon kathos ke krematistai moseis melon epitalein ten skenein Horak arphazen, poieses panta kata tantipan tan dekthenta soi en to aure. Now, these people who offer according to the law, the writer now describes them with a hustis, this form of hustis, and the masculine plural nominative becomes hoi tines, who, or who themselves, a pattern, a hippodigmata, and a skia, those are both dative nouns, but they're dative because they follow the verb worship or serve, la triuo. So you serve something in the dative. So who serve a pattern and shadow, ton ipu epuraneon, of the heavenly things. So that genitive actually modifies hypodigmata and skia, who serve a pattern and shadow of the heavenly things, just as Moses was revelationed. Krematizo means to reveal by revelation, among other things. And this is actually a perfect, I think it's middle. It could be perfect indicative passive, but I think the lexicon indicated that it would probably be a middle form, and it means receive revelation in the middle. Just as Moses received revelation, and now we have a participle. Mello, as you probably remember, means to be about to do something, or as Texans say, to be fixing to do something. And we'll take it temporally with Moses as the referent, and we'll pretend it's in predicate position because there's no article anywhere on either Moses or the participle. So we take it temporally. Just as Moses received revelation as he was about to complete or about to bring to completion the tabernacle. And here's the quote from Exodus 25. Hara is the present imperative from harao, second singular. See, right? For see, facin. Now this is something that hardly any other writer does. It's a narrative interruption. It's from phemi, and it's just the present indicative active third singular. See, it says, right? And that's why in the editors help us out, because they have the quote in italics, but gar facin is not in italics. So you're supposed to be able to figure it. So see, for see, it says, poieses, you will make, or you will do, all things, panta, according to the type or pattern, which one? The having been shown to you on the mountain one. And dekthenta is from, anybody? Dekhtimi, right. It's actually the aorist participle passive, and it would be masculine, singular, accusative, modifying, tipon, pattern. Okay. And so it's interesting to me, as this came clear some time ago, I think essentially there are two exegetical hooks on which this entire argument about Christ's priestly superior high priestly office hinges or hangs. And the first one is Psalm 110, verse 4. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And the other one is this one from Exodus 25, that when Moses erected the tabernacle, that he was doing so in imitation, in what would we say, temporary imitation of the heavenly tabernacle, of which he saw the pattern and built the skene. So I mean, it's a very interesting argument. So, and the writer to the Hebrews, of course, is saying that Christ's, the tabernacle in which Christ offered the sacrifice, is the heavenly one, not the earthly one. See, and that's all a men, and we're about to get the deh. Okay? So let's kind of, you know, reach back to verse 4, and we'll do 4 and 5 together, and then we'll get the deh in verse 6. We have a couple of minutes left.
Absolutely. Yesterday, last week. In verse 2, this tais alethinais.
Yes.
What does that mean, the true? That's not true as opposed to the false, but is it more real?
Yeah, well, again, yeah, remember that he's not, the writer to the Hebrews is not a Marcionite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
See, so it's like salvation historically true, or something like that.
It's truer, it's the pleroma, it's the fulfillment.
Yeah.
It's not in opposition to.
No, it's only in opposition if you want to hold on to the old skene, mm-hmm. Then you get an opposition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to aletheia, which is true
I think it's context.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the antonym is provided by the context.
Okay.
Right. Right. And in this case, it's probably true in terms of who the builder is, because God pegged that one to the ground, so to speak, and not a man, not Moses. Mm-hmm. Right. See? So yeah, I mean, the writer to the Hebrews is sometimes accused of being a little Platonic,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I think if you read him in isolated fashion, it really sounds like that. But you know, when you get the sweep of the argument, it's really very salvation historical. And yes, you do have a kind of a, you have sort of the parallel heavenly and earthly realities, but it's all in service to, you know, moving toward the consummation of the ages.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a little different,
when
if I can say it that way.
Merge.
Yeah. When heaven and earth come back together, if you will. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
It's just a strange concept.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, right. On a bad day, I'm glad that Hebrews is anti-legomena. On a good day, I feel fine about it. So, yeah, not that how I feel is all that important, right? So let's do 4 and 5, and then we'll get a running start. Therefore, if on the one hand he were on the earth, not even would he be a priest, because there are those who offer gifts according to the law, who serve a pattern and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses received a light revelation as he was about to complete the tabernacle. See, it says, you will make all things according to the pattern which is shown to you on the mountain. And see, now look, verse 6 begins with nune. I think that's not only a logical now, but I think it's a historical now. See, now, at the fullness of time, to sound like Paul for just a second, right? So let's get verse 6, I think we should get to the end of the paragraph or we'll be stuck in the midst of salvation history here. So verse 6, Nuneda diaphoteras tetichen liturgias hazo kai kretanas esten diathekes mezites hetes epi kretosin epangeli eis ne namothetetai. Break out your lexicon, right? But now, where's the verb? Where's the verb? Tetichen. This is from Tinkano. Okay? And this is actually, it has to see the duplication. This is a perfect indicative active, third singular, of Tinkano, which means to grasp, reach, attain, receive. Right? So he, Christ, has attained. But now he has attained, and diaropheteros is comparative adjective. It means mattering more. You know, it's supposed to, it's not a diaphora, it's diaphora. And it's not just diaphora, it's diaphoteros. So he has attained or achieved a liturgias, a service. What kind of a service? A mattering more service. And I think it's sometimes just translated greater or more significant service. Huzo, by as much as also estin, he is mezites, predicate nominative, he is the mediator. Reach back to kretanas and hook it with diathekes. Kretanas is the comparative of agathos. It means better, right? Good, better. He is the mediator of a better covenant, which, upon better promises, has been enacted. Namathateo means to enact by legislation. Okay? So, and the word order there is pretty random, at least to us. So it's almost time to stop. So I'll just go back through it one more time. But now, he, Tetichen, has attained or obtained or achieved a more significant liturgical, cultic, sacrificial service by as much as also he is the mediator of a better covenant. And now let's talk about the covenant. Hetus is feminine, right? Which, on the basis of better promises, has been enacted.
You got it. Oh.
I just killed a bee online. That was a big
one.
Sure.
3-5.
That's right.
That was huge.
That was huge. I know. This is like a satanic bee. He wanted to interfere with the reading of God's word.
Wow.
Well, that was excitement at Greek. We haven't had that much excitement. Bob, I'm glad you came today. This is excitement at Greek Club.
So. You know, the Hebrew word for bee is Deborah.
Deborah? Really?
Yes. Oh, yeah. She's really? The killer bee in Judges 4.
Someone probably has preached a sermon using that rhetoric.
Really, yeah.
You all probably should.
Yeah, you should.
Well, with that exciting conclusion, this is Greek Club. And thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. That was interesting.
Blood smear.
Don't tell Chuck Darren about that. Yeah, that wasn't like a
blood in it, though.
We're not living together with our creatures here.